This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The heat is back. Extreme climate denial. Where does it come from?
Well, when you peel back the mask of environmentalism, you always come face to face with eugenics and mass death every single time.
I just read you other gurus saying we need authoritarianism, eco-fascism is loving, eco-fascism is good. They are coming with weapons. They are militarizing all the major environmental groups. They're going to rule you. They are parasites. They are bloated scum, filth, trash. We're going under criminal takeover. Criminal murderers. We'll be back.
Is doubt about climate science manufactured? Dr. Naomi Oreskes has a unique marriage of expertise in both global warming and the history of science. She is a professor at the University of California, San Diego. Her early books were on geophysics, plate tectonics, and continental drift theory. But now, Naomi enters a more public battle with her newest book, Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on Issues from Tobacco Smoke to Global Warming. Dr. Oreskes, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me on the show.
During my own research in the early 1990s, I kept bumping up against a group of scientists promoting dubious products like tobacco and even asbestos.
Mm-hmm.
And they were joined by other authority figures like Dixie Lee Ray, a former governor of Washington State who never met a toxic chemical she didn't like. Many of the press releases came from the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Are these some of the figures in your book, Merchants of Doubt?
Yes, absolutely. And that is exactly really what the book is all about. It's about a pattern where we see the same people and the same organizations cropping up repeatedly, as you say, to defend toxic chemicals, to defend pollution, to claim that pollution isn't harmful. And then in the final chapter of our book, or the final issue, to say that there is no global warming.
I suppose the surprise isn't so much that big polluters hire spokespeople, even scientists. My question is, how did such a small number of people get so much media attention? They looked like an equal half in a public debate when they weren't. How did they do it?
Exactly. Well, that's exactly the question that we pose, because as you say, it's not exactly surprising that the tobacco industry would try to downplay the harms of tobacco, or the chemical industry would try to downplay the harms of toxic chemicals. But there were two things that we thought were surprising. One was, why would reputable scientists participate in such an activity? And the other, as you say, how did they manage to have so much impact? So the answer to the first question we discuss in the book at great length is really ideological. And in the book, we show that the scientists who became involved in these activities were not selling out for money, at least not directly, not in the sense of their own personal gain. They were really motivated by an ideological commitment to free markets and a fear, it's really fear-driven, a fear that if the government took steps to control whether it was acid rain or global warming or DDT, that that would lead to encroaching government control of all aspects of our life. So that ideological drive helps to understand why otherwise reputable scientists would do and say a lot of really, in our view, disreputable things. Now, on the question of how they had so much impact, so there's two parts to that. The first has to do with their reputations. The tobacco industry learned early on that if they said that tobacco was good for you, most of us wouldn't be so stupid as to think that that was credible. But if they could hire distinguished scientists to say, well, you know, science is a very complicated business, and there's a lot of things about cancer that we don't understand, and it's not really clear that tobacco is as hazardous as some extremists are claiming. If they could get a president of the National Academy of Sciences to say that, then that would have credibility, and the press would take that seriously. So this was really a crucial part of the strategy that we document very clearly in the book, the recruitment of distinguished, prestigious scientists. And it's been ironic for us because, you know, we've been attacked recently by one of the children of one of the people we write about in the book, a son, and his defense of his own father was to say, my father was a very distinguished scientist. And we say, yes, that's exactly the point.
And who were some of those prestigious scientists?
Well, in the book, we track a group of three crucial scientists and a fourth one who joined them a little later, who created a think tank called the George C. Marshall Institute in Washington, D.C. And the Marshall Institute was really dedicated to this concept of fighting government regulation as the slippery slope to socialism. And the three we track in particular were all physicists, and they were all Cold Warriors who had worked in Cold War rocketry and weapons programs. And it was that Cold War connection that was related to their political views, which were deeply, deeply anti-communist, really took very, very seriously the idea of Soviet domination, communist domination. But when the Cold War ended, really couldn't let go. It's like they kept fighting the Cold War even after the Cold War was over. And they saw the threat of communism everywhere, you know, even in things like climate science.
I suppose it's inevitable the profitable polluters will also try to influence politics and social policy. We see the most recent exposés of the multi-billionaire Koch brothers, for example, and they donated to earlier anti-environmental think tanks along with Exxon and chemical companies. But I have to say the same billionaires and mega corporations also pay for a lot of university buildings and professional chairs at universities and scientific research. So is it going to be possible to maintain an airtight wall between corporate ideology and science?
Well, no, of course. I don't think it will ever be possible to have an airtight wall. But I think that, you know, air is the key, right? Fresh air and sunshine and bringing things to light is really the key to understanding what's going on. So, as you say, a corporation has the right to present its views in public, and I don't think anybody would deny that. But what's kind of worrisome about this story that we tell is the way in which they hide their influence, the way they hide their tracks. So you mentioned earlier on the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and they are indeed one of the groups that appears in our story, along with the Marshall Institute, the Cato Institute, and a number of other of these organizations. And they receive funding from various different corporate sources and also conservative and libertarian foundations. But because they appear to be independent, they seem to have a credibility that we might not otherwise grant them if we knew that, you know, if the money were coming directly or the comments, but, you know, the arguments were coming directly from industry. And also, again, you mentioned the press earlier. This is where the press are really key, because these things seem to be coming from think tanks that seem to be independent and seem to be credible. The press quote them very extensively, and we've seen in the climate change debate, in many cases, prestigious newspapers like the Washington Post or the New York Times will quote spokespeople from the Competitive Enterprise Institute. But those spokespeople are, in fact, presenting the views of industry. And we've seen this very extensively recently with the Cato Institute. There's a man named Patrick Michaels who's been a very vocal voice doubting the scientific evidence of global warming or doubting the severity of it. Or most recently, last year when there was the incident of the stolen emails from the United Kingdom, he was very, very vocal in saying, look, this proves what I've been saying all along. You know, there's something wrong in the state of climate science, and he was very extensively quoted, even in the New York Times. But the fact is the Cato Institute gets most of its support from corporations that have a very strong vested interest in not seeing legislation on climate change. And one of those groups is the very ones you just mentioned, the Koch Industries, who are the largest controllers of oil and gas pipelines in the United States.
It seems like a very complex machine with a lot of curtains that keeps the public from making the dots, connecting the dots. Can we call it a conspiracy?
Of course. Well, we get asked that question all the time. And of course, you can call it anything you want. I have to be more careful, right? I don't like to use the word conspiracy because, you know, for a lot of people that conjures up illegality. And one of the things that's really important about this story is to understand how these folks, as far as we know, did not do anything illegal. They were very, very careful to make sure that everything they said, everything they did was within the bounds of the law, and also in many cases, not always, but in most cases, not to actually lie. And this is in a way the beauty, but also the hideousness of the strategy, right? And again, this was developed by the tobacco industry. What they realized was that you didn't have to lie, that science, real science, is complicated. And often people don't actually understand complicated science, and it's not their fault. You know, these things are complex issues. Experts spend decades trying to work these things out, so it's not surprising that many of us would have trouble understanding the details of the science. And this is really crucial, there is always uncertainty in all science. Science never proves anything absolutely positively. So so it was this reality, this truth, that the tobacco industry and then all of those who followed exploited. They took the real uncertainty, the natural uncertainty in all science, they took the real complexity of science, and they tried to use that to make us think that we really didn't know the answer to these questions. You used the phrase at the very beginning of the show, is doubt about climate science manufactured? And we always say, no, it's not manufactured. There's always reasonable doubt in any live debate. Anytime people are studying, anytime people are asking questions, it's in the very nature of science, in the very nature of inquiry, that of course there's doubt. Doubt is what drives science. But these people take that and they use it against science. So it's almost like a jujitsu move where they take what's a strength of science, the way doubt drives curiosity, and they turn it against it.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock every Sunday night at 10:30 p.m. right here on Green 960 online and Radio San Francisco.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with scientist and author Naomi Oreskes. Naomi, I'd have to say the strategy of creating doubt in our public minds about established science, it has worked. America still has no legislation to limit greenhouse gases. Canada doesn't. How costly in terms of damage to our future climate do you think this delay is? I mean, will our grandchildren call it criminal, as James Hansen has suggested?
Well, we think it's pretty costly. In the book, we try as much as possible to let the reader come to their own conclusions about that. But I think any reader who, you know, picks up the book will see that there's a pattern. And the pattern is that in every one of the cases we document, from the original debates about tobacco to the current debates about global warming, that there's been very substantial delay between the time that the science was established and the time that something was actually done about it. And that period of delay led to a lot of profits for a lot of people, but it also led to a lot of damage to the environment. It led to, in the case of tobacco, a lot of what we would argue would probably be unnecessary deaths from cancer and other tobacco-related diseases. So there's a real cost. And as you said, you know, global warming is the unfinished business because we've known about the reality of global warming for a long time now, and yet we continue not to do anything about it. And what's really damaging, of course, in the case of global warming is that the damage is irreversible. So every day we delay, every month, every year, every decade, because we're now talking about decades of delay, the problem gets worse. It gets harder to solve. Is it criminal? Well, I let that for the lawyers to decide.
Good enough. Well, in your book, Merchants of Doubt, you show this repetitive strategy, misusing a few scientists and other authorities. My question now, after 30 years of the same old song and dance, why do we keep falling for it? Doesn't that suggest that the consumer, too, has been willing to hear reasons why we should just keep on polluting? Aren't we, as we belch out our carbon and buy things from the Walmart and stripping resources from the planet, aren't we part of this conspiracy? Is that why we accept it?
Of course we are all part of it. And elsewhere, Eric Conway and I have written things about what individuals can do, and we've certainly spoken on this issue. And certainly we do agree with psychologists who say, look, if somebody is given a choice between two accounts, one of which says, wow, things are really bad, you need to change the way you do business, and the other which says, oh, everything's fine, don't worry. You know, most of us would prefer to hear the everything's fine, don't worry. So, of course, individuals play a role in this. Individuals accept these messages of doubt. But we still think that, you know, responsibility should be laid squarely where it most belongs. And I think, you know, when we were writing this book, we knew something about some of these earlier debates about the ozone hole and acid rain, a little bit about tobacco. But it wasn't until we wrote this book that we realized how extensive this pattern was, how repetitive, and how much we really had been, in a way, conned. So I think that, you know, an ordinary person who's busy with their own life maybe hasn't seen the pattern, maybe hasn't had someone connect the dots for them. And so what we've really tried to do in the book is to show that pattern, to connect the dots, so a person can pick up the book and read it and say, oh my gosh, I really didn't know this. And we have had lots of people, even scientists who are involved in doing the scientific work on many of the issues, have said to us, oh my gosh, I really didn't know this.
Have you had any blowback from the Merchants of Doubt? Do you get heat for exposing what they do?
Well, of course. And as I said, there is a son of one of the merchants of doubt who's been very vocal on the Internet, accusing us of being irresponsible historians and making false allegations, actually, about our historical work. And it's a difficult challenge to know whether one should respond to these accusations or not. We think our work stands for itself. Anyone who picks up the book will see there's a lot of footnotes in the back. We spent 5 years doing the research, so we feel pretty confident that the work stands.
Despite some belated apologies from the media, scientists are still under attack, not just in dictatorial countries, but right in the United States. The Attorney General of Virginia, as you know, Ken Cuccinelli, tried to investigate Dr. Michael Mann, formerly from the University of Virginia, and the famous hockey stick author, modeling rising global temperatures. And this Attorney General did not believe in human-induced climate change, and he wanted to charge Dr. Mann with fraud. That was tossed out. But the specter of right-wing governments investigating climate scientists won't go away. We've got elections coming up, plenty of climate deniers running for office. Is it safe to be outspoken about climate research in this political climate?
Well, it's not safe. And as you point out, many people who have spoken out, even people who haven't spoken out publicly, just scientists who have been doing their work as scientists, have been attacked. And they have been attacked, as you pointed out, by the U.S. government. And that is a very frightening state of affairs. Yeah, it's very worrisome, and I think it speaks to what's at stake here. And it's not surprising that people are fighting back tooth and nail because there is a lot at stake. Energy use is at the root of all economic activity, and I think we have to be prepared. I think in some ways, scientists, environmentalists, at least if you go back to the 1990s, I think a lot of scientists involved in the climate issue, I have to say, were naive. I think they thought that if they did really good scientific work and if they demonstrated the evidence and if they explained it clearly, then people would understand what was at stake, they would understand the threat, and we would get action. And at first, it looked like that was true. So if you think about the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change in 1992, it was signed by President George H.W. Bush and 163 other signatories from around the world. It did look as if the world was ready to take action on the basis of the clear scientific evidence. But then, and in the book we show how the resistance then builds up as the scientific evidence gets stronger and stronger, the resistance also gets stronger and stronger too, to the point that we now see the literal harassment of honest scientists stealing their emails. I have colleagues who have received death threats. I've received threatening phone calls. You know, it's an ugly world out there. People are worried about what this means. So I do think that we have to be realistic. We have to realize that, you know, there are some very unpleasant people out there who will do anything to protect their own self-interest. And so it is really important, I think, for everyone to support climate scientists, to understand that they're the victims of attack. So when their emails get stolen, to realize that this is pernicious, this is deliberate, it's a deliberate attempt to discredit them. And really for the press, as you mentioned yourself, it's really crucial that the press understand this and the press stop quoting these people who are not independent, they're not scientists. Don't quote them as if they're scientists. If you want to say the oil and gas pipeline industry feels XYZ, fine. That's a perfectly legitimate thing. It's legitimate for us to know what the position of the oil and gas pipeline industry is. But it's not legitimate to take that position, to dress it up as if it were science, and then to present it as a scientific debate.
I'm sorry to tell you, and I know you're coming on a tour or at least some speaking in Canada, but things are no better in Canada. Dr. Andrew Weaver of the University of Victoria, just in today's paper, and he's an IPCC team leader, says new government regulations are muzzling scientists. All requests for interviews from the national and international press must first be cleared with scientists' responses approved in advance by the mandarins and the political departments right up to the ministers signing off. And of course, that takes so long, the press have gone away by the time the story has died. Politicians can rewrite what scientists say or deny them access altogether. There's no free speech for taxpayer-funded scientists in Canada. Dr. Weaver calls it Orwellian. Have you heard about that?
I did. I saw that piece, and I actually saw it last night, and it is very, very worrisome, and I especially think for Canadians who often pride themselves as being maybe a little bit of a step ahead of the United States on some of these issues, I think it's a huge source of concern. And again, I think it shows the extreme steps that people are now taking to suppress the scientific evidence, because the scientific evidence is so strong and it is so compelling, and because if people understand it, they will see what's at stake. So I applaud Andrew Weaver for speaking out about what's going on. My view is that scientists should speak out. I think that scientists are often in a stronger position than they think. I really don't think the Canadian government wants to put scientists in jail. And, you know, James Hansen documented a very similar pattern that happened to him here in the United States. It's in his recent book on his experience. Every scientist should read James Hansen's book, as well as ours, of course. And I really think scientists have to not bow to this pressure. Scientists have to stand up and say they owe it to the people. As you said, this is funded by the taxpayers. Scientists owe it to the people to tell them the truth about what's going on. And if a government bureaucrat or a politician tries to stand in their way, it's really important for scientists to resist that political pressure.
And we've never needed impartial science more than now, especially climate science. How can the public support real science and the scientists? What can we do?
Well, that's a great question. I think, you know, you mentioned universities, obviously having public lectures, inviting scientists to speak on these issues, but community groups as well. I've been speaking to a lot of civic groups and religious organizations. Invite your local scientists to come and talk about these things. Invite them to come and talk in your school. Send them an email giving them moral support. You know, most of us who work on this issue, our inboxes are filled with hostile and negative things from people who feel threatened. We don't get as many nice, positive emails from people who appreciate what we do. Although I have to take that back and say that for me, since the book has come out, I've gotten incredibly gratifying emails from all over the world, and I want to thank everyone who's written to me and Eric, because it's really meaningful to us to know that people appreciate what we've done and they appreciate the hard work that went into this. So be supportive. Talk to your scientists. Invite them to speak in public. And then, as you said, there are things that you can do. You can vote. You can vote out politicians who are harassing scientists and refusing to act on these issues. You can organize in your own community. You can take steps to buy green products. There's a wonderful organization called Climate Counts based in New Hampshire who are raiding corporations for their activities with respect to global warming. You can get information and be an informed consumer. You know, there's a great line in the movie Food, Inc., when they say, what can you do about issues in the food industry? And they say, you know, when it comes to food, you vote three times a day, right? Every time you have a meal, you're making choices. Well, when it comes to energy, it's even more than that. You're voting 100 times a day. Every time you buy a product, every time you turn on your light, every time you get in your automobile, you're making a choice about energy issues and the environment. So I think we have a lot more power than we sometimes think, and I really think it's great, you know, that organizations like Climate Count are pointing out the ways in which consumers have power.
Is there a website for your new book that you'd like to point out?
There is. Thank you very much for asking. It's www.merchantsofdoubt.org.
Great. This is Radio EcoShock. We have been honored to have Naomi Oreskes as our guest. She has advised the EPA and the National Academy of Sciences. Her awards are many. Naomi, you have become something of a legend in the climate community. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you. And I am speaking at the University of Toronto and at York University at the end of the month. So if people are interested, they can go to the websites of those universities. They can find the information about my lectures in Toronto.
We'll do that. I'm Alex Smith.
Thank you so much.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.